It's good to be back. It's good to be back with you. I want to start with another poem by Denise Levertov. It's there. You probably already read it. But it's there. I might have used this a couple years ago because I don't go anywhere without this poem, but it's worth hearing again if you haven't heard it in the last 2 years. It's called Suspended. And as I read this poem, I just would invite you, there's such powerful images about life with God and challenges of life with God in this poem that I invite you just to be attentive to. Suspended. I had grasped God's garment in the void, but my hand slipped on the rich silk of it. The everlasting arms my sister loved to remember must have upheld my leaden weight from falling even so. For though I claw at empty air and feel nothing, no embrace, I have not plummeted. I'm just going to invite you in a minute of reflection on that, and then I'll read it again. I had grasped God's garment in the void, but my hand slipped on the rich silk of it. The everlasting arms my sister loved to remember must have upheld my leaden weight from falling even so. For though I claw at empty air and feel nothing, no embrace, I have not plummeted. I'm curious if there are any images or aspects of this poem that stick out to you or maybe resonate with your own experience of faith sometime over the years of your life. Yes, Bob or Bill? Bob or Bob? Yeah, it might be a different place, but I'm thinking of him in his book, Let Your Life Speak.
Yeah.
He talks about depression pushing him down, and his therapist helped him to see it differently, not as smashing him, but as pushing him to a place where he could regain some footing. Yeah, that's a beautiful image. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, in the literal sense, God is not tangible. So this is a rich image, right? This image, I had grasped God's garment, but my hand slipped on the rich silk of it. And you can kind of think of the image of God in Isaiah chapter 6, right? There's a clear image of God high and lifted up. His train filled the temple. Remember that image of God? And you get this picture of God in these rich robes. And one of the things I think we need images of God. You can't... we need pictures and metaphors. God is a mother hen. God is a rock. God is a fortress, right? These are all images or metaphors, and we need those. But there are deep traditions of Christian spirituality that say we also need to remember that God is beyond image, beyond words, beyond description. And this seems to be a picture of someone kind of trying to hold on to an image of God that maybe worked for them, that helped them, but it's slipping away, and they can't hold on to it anymore. Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes it's in reflection. I know when I, oftentimes when I'm experiencing grief, you know, I don't feel like I'm being uplifted or, in God's arms,
mm-hmm.
but it's afterwards realizing that I haven't fallen into an abyss.
Yeah.
God must have been there.
Yeah, right. So we can notice these things in retrospect. Not always in the moment. We can feel like we've been abandoned, like there's nothing holding us up. And in retrospect, we realize, but I didn't fall into an abyss. I was being held all along. Yeah. Yes?
That even in not being able to feel God, there's an absence of doubt. There's supposition that there is no God because of this. This is full of faith.
Right, it's full of faith, And yet it's not an experience we would relish, right? The sense of feeling nothing, no embrace. You've heard the phrase, a dark night of the soul. And that's exactly what I think this poem is characterizing, the sense that this feeling of God's absence, no positive sense of God's presence, and yet in the midst of that, the faith, the acknowledgement that I'm being somehow mysteriously upheld. Yeah.
Another thing, besides what you're talking about, faith is different, but the mind cannot grasp that. If you think of the mind as reason, mm-hmm. rationality, mm-hmm. God is something bigger than the whole cosmos, and you mm-hmm. can't even grasp the cosmos. So
right.
when you try to think about God, you really, it's like trying to grasp a garment mm-hmm. and it slips. You get mm-hmm. an idea, and it just, you can't even think it.
Right.
So what you're talking about, knowing God in your heart.
Right.
Your heart isn't like your mind.
Yeah. Psalms, so he's suggesting, and this is absolutely true, that our minds cannot fathom God. They cannot grasp, they cannot contain. St. Augustine said, why do you try to understand it? If you can understand it, it's not God. Right? And many of us live with gods who we can understand. Convenient gods that fit just where we need God in our lives, doing just what we hope God will do. Remember last week I talked about the false self pulling things and images and people into its orbit? Well, we can do that with God. But a God that we grasp in our orbit, that we hold on to, that fits neatly in our lives, is not God. It might be a reflection of God, it might be an aspect of God, but it's not God. Well, it's this image of grasping that I want to help us to lead into our theme for today. And I want to get into that by reading for you this scenario, completely hypothetical scenario. You will not recognize this in any church that you've ever been involved in. But when I was in North Carolina, this is what the churches were sometimes like. A scenario. A meeting of the worship committee of First United Methodist Church, Blandville, Pennsylvania. 2 weeks earlier, the pastor had said the committee needed to talk about music styles in worship. He said he'd heard some complaints, but that's all he said. The members of the committee, which included the music minister, the church organist, the director of the handbell choir, 2 choir members, and a youth representative, wondered what he was talking about. 2 weeks before the pastor called the meeting, the handbells had played 3 anthems in worship, and the service went over by 10 minutes. A week before, that's right. Now we're going to the heart of things, right? A week before that, a new youth worship band had asked to play in worship, and the pastor said he'd bring it before the worship committee. The organist had heard that some members of the trustees were talking about replacing the pipe organ with an electric organ so that a new projector and screen could be installed in the sanctuary. Before the meeting, the handbell choir director called all the members of the handbell choir and told them to start talking about how important handbells are. She also encouraged them to write letters to the chair of the worship committee, a choir member, and the pastor. The organist had acquired the names of 150 on a secret petition to keep the pipe organ, and the youth representative had recorded testimonies of youth who were thinking about going to other churches where they liked the music. At the meeting itself, before the pastor could even say why he called the meeting, the organist, handbell director, and youth representative got in a heated argument about which was more important in worship, bells, organ, or youth participation. From that inauspicious beginning, the meeting did not improve. Now, there are lots of ways you could parse what's happening. If you're into something called family systems theory, you could see different kinds of triangling going on. If you're an organizational theorist, you could see other kinds of dynamics going on. If you've ever been a member of the church, you can just recognize a meeting that you were at once, perhaps. But I want to suggest one way of looking at this is to say this has nothing to do with music. The challenge in this situation is not about music. I want to suggest that it's the challenge of competing agendas. What's going on in here is the challenge of competing agendas. Folks are grasping, so to speak, clinging to their own agendas. An agenda, in the way I'm using it, is just another way of saying, the way I want it. The way I want it. And when we live, or work, or pray, or lead, if you happen to be the chair of one of these beautiful church committees, when we do any of those things, in order to make sure that the way we want it turns out, that we get things the way we want them, we are in the grip of agendas. We're working with and being held on to by agendas. Now, I happen to think that 90% of conflict in congregations, though we're not going to talk about that for very long today, 90% of conflict in congregations is about the clash of often shallow competing agendas. Notice in the scenario that I suggested, they're all about preferences in certain groups of the congregation clashing with one another. Preferences about music, preferences about style of music. There's no openness to begin with to say, how might God be leading us in the way we should be in worship together? That possibility is completely closed down because of these competing agendas. Now, there's a good 10% of conflict in congregations that is necessary, useful conflict about what is good and true and beautiful and necessary. And we've got to have those kinds of conflicts. But we can't have them and have them well when all we're doing is perseverating about the shallow agendas that structure our lives and our engagements. So when you find yourself in a church meeting and you notice yourself getting anxious as you know, straw votes are being taken, and you see that the way you wanted things to work out might not come to pass, that's a sign that there's an agenda inside of you that feels at threat. Or when you breathe, I've never done this, but when you breathe a sigh of relief that Betty was hired as the preschool director and not Martha. Oh, thank goodness. I've never done that. And if I had, I would be using different names, of course. That's an indication there might have been some kind of agenda at work. Now, in the Methodist Church, we have something called the Nominating Committee. And this is the committee that nominates people for all the other committees. And when you find yourself wanting to get on the Nominating Committee so that you can get all the right people, you know what that means, on all the other committees, that's a sign, right, that there's an agenda at play, an agenda that we're clinging to. Now, I don't want to spend the morning talking about church leadership and church conflict. We might get back to leadership just a little bit later. But we're here to talk about prayer. And last week I said prayer is becoming increasingly open and available and receptive to the transforming work of God's Spirit in our lives. If you're here last week, I hope that sounds familiar. Being completely open and available and receptive to the transforming work of God's Spirit in our lives. But that's just another way of saying that we want to live lives that are open and available and receptive to the transforming work of God's Spirit in our lives. And we can't be that. We can't be open. We can't be available. We can't be receptive to how God is leading in our lives, in our communities, if we are being controlled by agendas. We think they're our agendas, but it's really the agendas that have a grip on us. I have a favorite children's book called Where the Red Fern Grows. I bet some of you read that to your children or grandchildren. And in the book Where the Red Fern Grows, a boy named Billy wants to learn how to hunt raccoons. He's desperate to hunt raccoons. And so he goes to his grandpa's shop, who runs a little store, and he tells him how desperate he is to hunt raccoons. And grandpa says, I can show you how to catch raccoons without tracking, without dogs, without shooting. All you got to do is set a trap. And so Billy says, okay, grandpa, tell me, what do I do? What do I do? And grandpa says, well, you find a log, and you drill a hole in the log a few inches deep, about the diameter of a penny. And then you take a nail, and you nail the nail into the log so that it bisects the hole. It goes through the hole. And then he says you find a piece of tin foil or something shiny, a shiny piece of metal, and you put it down in the bottom of the hole. There you go, you've got your trap. Oh, Billy says, how's that going to catch a raccoon? And Grandpa says, well, raccoons love shiny things. And when the raccoon sees the little piece of foil or tin in the bottom of that hole, the raccoon will reach his open paw into the hole past the nail to grab the shiny thing. But with the piece of tin or foil in its paw, it won't be able to get the paw out past the nail. It's trapped. Oh, Billy says, it can just let go. It can just let go. And Grandpa says, it can, but it won't. It loves it too much. It's trapped. And that's what it's like to be in the grip of an agenda. No longer free. We love it too much. We're trapped. Someone working with or being held by agendas cannot see other possibilities because they're so determined to have things their way. That's the challenge of agendas. And not just in communities, but in our lives as well. Now, the history of Christian spirituality has another way of talking about agendas. And it uses a term, if you're familiar with other spiritual traditions, especially some Buddhist traditions, you might be more familiar with this term from that tradition, but it's firmly established in Christianity. We talk about attachments. Attachments. It's the way I think Christian spirituality once helps us to talk about what agendas are like. You've heard this phrase, an attachment, right? An attachment. Margaret Silf, who is a writer on the spiritual life, has this image. She says, imagine a big meat hook. It's not a pleasant image. Imagine a meat hook hanging from the ceiling, and then someone lifts you up and puts you on that meat hook. So you can see, you can kind of turn and swivel maybe a little bit, but you can't move. You're not free. You can't get around. And that's what the Christian spiritual traditions mean when we say we have an attachment. It means we're not free because we're clinging so tightly or being clung to by what is keeping us. Things we're stuck to. They blind us, these Christian spiritual traditions say. Attachments blind us to what is true and what is godly and what is necessary, what is good. And you can be attached to almost anything. I mean, literally, almost anything. You can be attached to an idea. Or, of course, when an idea becomes an attachment, then we begin to call it an ideology. Right? You can be attached to an idea. You can be attached to a person. You can be attached to a car. There's a nice little blue Audi that drives around my neighborhood. And every time we see that blue Audi, I tell the kids, when I have my midlife crisis, I'm buying a blue Audi. That's what I want. I've been writing a book on spirituality in midlife, which I just sent to my editor last night at 8 o'clock. But I mentioned the blue Audi in the book about wanting this blue Audi and how I should start saving perhaps for it right now. Well, it turns out the blue Audi is owned by my third grade teacher's, my third grader's teacher. And so I said, now, Mary Claire, when the book comes out, you got to take the book to your teacher and show her that her blue Audi is in the book. Right, so we can be attached to almost anything. We can be attached to that image of God that's working for us, right? And that was the image I tried to use last week when I talked about the false self pulling things into its orbit, holding on to them just insofar as they shore up our sense of self. They work for us. Do you remember that? That's an image of an attachment. One of the things that I think we can get attached to, and so I just want to spend a little bit of time on this, is we can become attached to images of ourselves. We can become attached to images of ourselves. Ways we imagine ourselves being in the world that don't say the whole truth of who we are. But we think they do. And they help us get by. So we hold on to them. Right? We grasp feverishly to these images of ourselves, hoping that nothing will pull them from us. Frederick Buechner, that Presbyterian writer and minister, says, "Dreams of fame and fortune die hard, if they ever die at all." Right? We can imagine these images of ourselves that we hold on to. And so it's useful in the Christian spiritual life to ask ourselves, what images of ourselves are we clinging to that help us? I mean, the image of the martyr, right? Or the image of the hero. Or the image of the family's Messiah. Someone in the family is attached. Think of your own family. It might be you. Is this? I'm the one who saves the family. I'm the one who holds the family together. And we can cling to these images of ourselves like a sailor cast overboard, clinging to a life preserver, because we think this image of myself is me. And we know how painful it is when we stumble or we fall and this image of ourselves gets pulled out from under us like a rug, and we don't know who we are anymore. Now, one of the ways the Christian tradition has led us astray, it has overemphasized pride, right? We're attached to prideful images of ourselves, and we think those are lofty images of ourselves. So if you're a Methodist minister, then you get attached to an image of yourself of being elected bishop someday, right? Because it's a pride, although I don't know who would want that kind of job, but it's a prideful image. Or if you're a seminary professor, you imagine yourself being a dean someday, right? A prideful image. But it's not always a prideful image. And this is, some of us are attached to other images of ourselves that you think we would want to let go of. I think there's a quotation from Thomas Merton on your handout, but if it's not, I'm going to read it to you anyway, a short quotation. Because he wants to help us rethink pride. I guess it's not on there, I apologize for that. But this is pretty clear. He says, "Pride is the stubborn insistence on being what we are not and were never intended to be." Isn't that a great line? Pride is the stubborn insistence on being what we are not and were never intended to be. Sometimes that can be a too lofty image of ourselves, grandiose image of ourselves, but just as often it can be a not lofty image enough. Right? We can imagine ourselves as being the helpless one, or the incapable one, or the one that needs other people always to lift us up. The one who's always a screw up, right? The one who's never good enough. We don't, our families can give us these images, and we carry them around forever. And you'd think we'd want to get rid of it, right? This image I carry of myself as the one who's never good enough, never measures up. But having an image of myself, even if it causes me pain, is better than nothing at all. And even the image of myself as the one who never measures up, I can still cling to that because it can orient me in my world. It can help me understand who I am, even if I don't like it. So we can be attached to images of ourselves. And when we're attached to images of ourselves, when we are clinging to unreality. Rowan Williams calls this self-dramatizing and fantasy, former Archbishop Bishop of Canterbury. Self-dramatizing and fantasy. We cling to a false world, and it becomes the reality we live in. So, we can be attached to many things. People, cars, ideas, God, images of God, spiritual practices, and also images of ourself. The key from the perspective of Christian spiritual traditions is that when we're attached, when we have an attachment to whatever it is, now I'm not talking about like the necessary attachment to your parent when you're younger so you can develop a solid sense of self. I'm talking about adult attachments that keep us from being free. When we have these kinds of attachments, we do not have inner freedom. We are not free. Jesus says the truth will set you free, right? God wants to free us from these attachments so that we can be available, open to serve God, to be led by God, to discern how God is present in our lives. But we don't have that inner freedom when we're in the grip of attachments. And so there's another word on the other side of attachment that is useful to think about. Now, some traditions talk about detachment or non-attachment. If you practice mindfulness or you've read in Buddhist meditation, all you've heard about non-attachment or detachment. But one of the Christian traditions that stems from Ignatius of Loyola in the 16th century gives us a different word. And that word is indifference. That doesn't sound very happy, does it? Because we think about indifference meaning simply I don't care. Indifference. But that's not what it means. It really means in this tradition to be free of our attachments. To be free of our attachments. To not enter into a venture already having predetermined how it should end up. Those folks going to that worship committee meeting, the handball director, the youth representative, and the choir and the organist, they did not have indifference when they walked in the room. They already had their minds made up about how the meeting should go, so they were not free. So here's a trite example. I think the last time I was here a couple years ago, I talked about reading scripture in the Ignatian spiritual traditions, and so I might have mentioned indifference then. And if I told this story, I apologize. But who remembers things for 2 years? So anyway, but I remember one morning I was in my office and it was about 11 in the morning and I was hungry and I began to have this vision of Taipei's Crab Rangoon. Taipei's a Chinese restaurant near where we live. This vision of, I knew it was from the Holy Spirit telling me, go to Taipei for dinner. And all afternoon I kept thinking about Taipei Crab Rangoon. So at 5:30, I walked in the door and I said, kids, guess what? We're going out for dinner tonight. And they said, yay, let's go to Chili's. They started, wait a minute. They ran into the kitchen where Ginger was. Oh, Mom, Dad's going to take us to Chili's for dinner. 20 minutes later, I'm sitting in Chili's eating an overpriced cold quesadilla. And the question is, did I cling so tightly to that image of Crab Rangoon that my evening is ruined? Right? That I'm despondent, angry, frustrated? Was I so attached to that? Or do I have the freedom within me to be there in the moment, eat the quesadilla, be with my family, enjoy the evening, even though I didn't get what I wanted? Right? So I can either be attached or I can be indifferent. Now, like I said, that's a trite example. But when the question is about our freedom to serve God, Bob, we were talking about discovering our spiritual gifts in retirement. Right? If you recently retired, you might find that you have a new space in which you can discern how God is leading you. But if you're bound by attachments, then you're not free to be attentive to and responsive to how God is showing you you can be of service in the world. So James Martin is a Jesuit priest, and he writes this. It's an interview with Krista Tippett to show, I think, better how indifference works. Krista Tippett, what's her... On Being, this wonderful program On Being... Well, he says, Ignatius wanted to free us to be free of anything that kept us from following God. He called them disordered attachments. And the idea is that if anything keeps you from being more open to God's will in your life, get rid of it, basically. A simple example, when I was a Jesuit novice, the first part of the Jesuit training, I went to my novice director, and we were supposed to be assigned to different ministries working with the poor the first year of our novitiate. And I said, well, you know what? The last thing I want to do, I said, is work in a hospital. I don't think I could stand that, the smells and the sights and the sounds. And he said, well, good. Then you'll be working in a hospital. And why is he doing that? It wasn't to punish me. It was to kind of free me up from that. So his insight was, which is a very classic Jesuit insight, if that is something that's going to be preventing you from meeting people and from doing your ministry, you need to let go of it. And the way to let go of it in this case was to kind of experience it. And now I can go into hospitals. And imagine a priest who is so unfree that he couldn't set foot in a hospital, or a Jesuit who couldn't do that. So you see, he was not indifferent. He walked in to talk to his novice director, but he was not indifferent, because there was this one area where he couldn't go, where he didn't have freedom. And so, now in that case, the attachment was an aversion, which is a kind of attachment, right? If we can't go someplace, it's just like clinging to some other place, right? So he has an aversion, and he can't go into these places. So in the 16th century, Ignatius of Loyola wrote this. This is Ignatius's words. "It is necessary to make ourselves indifferent to all created things in all that is allowed to the choice of our free will and is not prohibited to it, so that on our part we want not health rather than sickness, riches rather than poverty, honor rather than dishonor, longer rather than short life, and so in all the rest, desiring and choosing only what is most conducive to the end for which we are created." And the end for which we are created is the free and full love of God and service of our neighbors. And so we have to be indifferent, free, in order to do that. Now, you're not Methodist, but John Wesley has a very famous prayer that reminds me a lot of this writing of Ignatius. John Wesley says, we often pray this in a covenant service on New Year's Eve, as we're thinking about how we're going to serve God in the next year. "Lord, make me what you will. I put myself into your hands. Put me to doing. Put me to suffering. Let me be employed for you or laid aside for you. Let me be full. Let me be empty. Let me have all things. Let me have nothing. I freely and with a willing heart give it all to your pleasure and disposal." That's a prayer asking for inner freedom. Asking to be free from our agendas, free from our attachments, so that we can be available to serve God. Now imagine that scenario I began with. We don't know what the pastor's agenda was, but no doubt he had one. What if he had been praying this prayer before the meeting? And what if the handbell director had been praying this prayer before the meeting? And what if the youth representative had been praying this prayer before the meeting? And what if the organist had been praying this prayer? So we go into the space saying essentially what Jesus prayed, "Not my will but thine be done." I want to be open. Let us notice how you're leading. Does God care how we worship? Then maybe God can lead in our midst, right? But they were not open to that possibility. So Ignatius and Wesley sound very similar. And it occurred to me that that might just be because they had both read the Apostle Paul, one of our fundamental sources. Notice what he writes in Philippians. "Yet whatever gains I had, these I have come to regard as loss because of Christ. More than that, I regard everything as loss because of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake I have suffered the loss of all things, and I regard them as rubbish, in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him. Not that I am referring to being in need, for I have learned to be content with whatever I have. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty. In any and all circumstances, I have learned the secret of being well fed and of going hungry, of having plenty and of being in need. I can do all things through him who gives me strength." A picture of availability, of openness, of the willingness to be in whatever situation God leads, so that we can be deeply serving and free. Yeah, what's that? Are you missing that page? Did you not have? Oh, I'm sorry. This maybe the. Yes, you do seem to be missing that page. That's okay. You're not attached. See, if you were. Now you will notice. This is actually good, right? Because different of us have different kinds of personalities. And some of us actually might be attached to those kinds of things, right? And we need to follow along. We need to know exactly where we are and where we're going, right? And if you found yourself not able to pay attention, getting antsy and nervous when you realize that page 3 was gone, then that's a place to notice. What is this attachment? I used to have, when I was a pastor, I remember how y'all laughed when we talked about the service going 10 minutes over, right? Well, I was more attached to getting out at 11 o'clock. Our service started at 10. Or maybe started at 11. No wonder I was attached to getting out at 12. But I was more attached to that than anyone else in the congregation. I'm convinced of it. I was desperately worried. I hated it when people... So I would wear my watch, and I would literally... I'm embarrassed to say this, but I would have conversations with the choir director that went like this. How long is the anthem? You know, is it 3 minutes? Is it 4 minutes? Because I wanted to know, should we put it during the offertory, or should it be its own anthem, right? And depending on how long it was. Talk with the children's minister. You know, the children's sermon was 6 minutes long. That's, you know, a third of a regular sermon. They don't need to be that long. Right, and finally I realized this is an attachment. And it is inhibiting my ability to worship because I'm constantly looking at my watch. So finally I stopped wearing my watch in church. I had to just leave it in my office because I knew I was not free. My watch was like was binding me. So we laugh, but there are those little things that we can be attentive to. We can notice the way, maybe that's you in worship, always more worried about when you're going to get out than what the Spirit is doing in our midst. When I was in elementary school, we often would go to visit my grandmother. My grandmother lived in Muncie, Indiana, and she and Pappy, Grammy and Pappy, would take my brother and I to Mounds State Park. And I remember one time in particular, we went to Mounds State Park and we had a wonderful, we would pick Kentucky Fried Chicken and get a watermelon. My grandfather was a retired grocer, so we'd always stop at Marsh Supermarket and get watermelon and fixins. And we'd had a great picnic, and Pappy wanted to go fish, so he walked away by himself. But Granny was willing to take my brother and I out in a rowboat. And there was a little island in this lake at Mounds State Park. And so we got in the rowboat, and it was a kind of windy day. It was hard, but my brother was the one rowing, and he got us out to this island, and we got up on the shore, and we explored the island a little bit. And then we got back in the rowboat, and it was my time to row back. And we got a little ways off, and I was rowing, and I was rowing, and it just wasn't going anywhere, but the winds had calmed down. And I was rowing, and I just couldn't. I mean, we'd go a little bit this way, and we'd go a little bit that way, where we weren't getting anywhere. Now, it wasn't April Fool's Day, but I noticed my grandmother and brother laughing in the back of the boat. And it turns out that they had dropped the anchor. There was a bucket of concrete with a rope on it, and they had thrown it over, and I wasn't able to go forward. I couldn't get it to go anywhere. Well, in the Christian tradition, it comes from Augustine. We're often given this image of the spiritual life as a sailboat. And we might say our spiritual practices, we've said open and available, responsive to God. Our spiritual practices are like the sail we put up on the boat in order to catch the wind of God's Spirit leading us. So we can go this way when the Spirit leads, and we can go this way when the Spirit leads. We're free. We're at the mercy of the wind of God. It's a beautiful image. But now imagine that boat or that life with an anchor thrown overboard in the back. Right? There's one of those anchors with the spiky edges on it, and it's clinging to the rocks at the bottom of the lake. And so the wind might be blowing, and the wind doesn't stop blowing. The wind might be blowing. The Spirit of God might be getting us to move, but we're stuck. We can't go. We're not free. And that's a picture of what these Christian spiritual traditions would call attachments. But I also think it's a picture of what I've been calling agendas. When we're holding on to our agendas, or when they're holding on to us, they're like that anchor at the back of the boat. And however we want to be open to what God is doing, transforming us, changing us, making us more like Christ for the sake of the world, as we said last week, we're not as free as we might be when that anchor is thrown. Right? So for James Martin, the anchor was his aversion to hospitals. There was an anchor holding him down. For me in worship, my anchor was my attachment to the timing. So I wasn't as free as I might be in that kind of moment. I was about to tell you that I'm going to skip something, but since it's not even on your handout, you won't know that I'm skipping something. So I want to talk through a practice. A way of praying, because these are practices of prayer. I think I hope I've been making clear what I mean by attachments and agendas. And so one of the things we can do in our life of prayer is begin to pray that we can notice what they are so that we can learn to let go of them, right? So that we can be more aware of the attachments that are controlling us. I mean, think about all the things we do because of aversions or attachments or attractions. And we're not aware. We're like marionette puppets, just being yanked to, and we think we're free, but we're not. Because we're being yanked around by these strings that are holding us, by the things we're holding on to. So we can begin in our lives, in our daily lives and in our prayer, to ask, what are my attachments? Where am I clinging? We can ask God to shine the light of God's wisdom into our lives in these areas so that we can begin to become increasingly free. And I call this 5 painfully difficult steps to becoming aware of our agendas. And the reason they're painfully difficult steps is exactly the reason you laughed last week when I said we were going to talk about our agendas, right? You said, I'm not coming, right? Because becoming aware of what we're clinging to, of what's holding us, can be painful at first until we realize that awareness is the first step to becoming increasingly free. So the first step, and some of these are not on your handout, I think you'll need to write them down. The first step in this process would simply be to notice. Begin to notice those places where you seem unfree. Now this takes some space, it takes some awareness, it takes a little bit of self-consciousness. But notice those places where you're unfree. And when you're noticing these things, there are a few things that are useful to notice. You can notice your feelings in a moment. When you're in, for instance, a meeting, or when you're at home and you begin to find yourself becoming anxious or afraid, that can sometimes be a sign that there's an agenda or an attachment that feels under threat. So you pay attention to your feelings. What you're feeling? Anxious, fearful. You might not even notice it. But think about the scenario I began with, that poor handball director and organist. They're really getting beat up, aren't they? That youth representative. But they all instantly reacted out of an anxious fear that they weren't going to get what they wanted. So they went into action, start getting putting a petition together, get people to call, write letters. So there was no space for them to notice and step back and say, whoa, what is going on in me? Why am I so afraid? Why am I so anxious? Where is this reaction coming from? So it's simply an invitation to become increasingly aware throughout our day of those places where often afflictive or uncomfortable feelings arise in us. Because that can often be a sign that the way I want something is under threat, or an image of myself is under threat, or feels like it might not happen. So we can notice our feelings throughout our day. When I'm sitting in a faculty meeting and I notice, you know, my colleague raising her hand to speak, and as soon as I see her hand go up, this anxiety and anger starts rising in me. Okay, now that's an occasion for me to keep my mouth shut and maybe go home later and ask, where's that coming from, right? That could be a sign that my own agendas are at play. So notice your feelings, but also notice your thoughts. Become aware of your thoughts in the moment, throughout the day. Do you perseverate about something? Is there something you simply can't let go of? Are your thoughts like that raccoon holding on to a shiny little thing and it simply can't let go of it? That can be an image of yourself. Do you catastrophize? Any of you catastrophizers? We can have a support group. Or do you catastrophize? Because, right, catastrophizing is just that replaying over and over an imagined scenario in the future when something that we want or some image of ourselves goes horribly wrong. And we just can't let go of it. So notice your thoughts and what's going on in your feelings, in your inner life. You notice these things, and it can become like a light bulb going off. Just a moment of awareness to say, what's going on here? And then in prayer, in your morning prayer, your evening prayer, you can ask for that light bulb to shine a little brighter. Help me understand. Give me insight, God, to what is going on here. The next step would be to probe, right? Most of the time, we just want to ignore. Ignore those feelings. Ignore those thoughts. I probably said this before because it's one of my favorite things to say. But Jim Gaffigan is a comedian, and he's quite funny. And he has one little routine where he says that it's 11 o'clock at night, and he's in the kitchen at the freezer. None of you will recognize this as well. He's at the freezer. He's holding a gallon of ice cream and eating the ice cream right out of the gallon. And his wife comes in and says, "Jim, do you really want to be, I mean, it's 11 o'clock at night, you just eat, look at you, do you want?" And he said, "Well, it's either eat the ice cream or feel my feelings." Right? Most of us choose to eat the ice cream. Right? Facebook is eating the ice cream. When my kids are on Instagram, it's eating the ice cream. Right? This invitation is to notice our, feel our feelings, which can be uncomfortable. Become aware. And then it gets worse because the invitation is to probe, to step back, and to begin to hit the pause button and probe a little more deeply. Maybe you don't know what's going on right away, where this is coming from, but you can enter into self-discovery. You can ask, why am I feeling this way? Why am I acting this way? What am I afraid of? Is there something I want? Is there a way I want things to be? Is there an image of myself? You know, those things we've just been talking about. You can begin to probe. For me, this happens a lot with a journal. On the back patio in the morning when I'm thinking about my previous day, I'll write about where was this feeling? What was going on? Yesterday afternoon, I was at a worship service installing the new district of the Pittsburgh's, the new superintendent of the Pittsburgh district. That's Methodist language. But the new boss around here for us Methodists. And it was a beautiful service. And I found myself sad during the service. It was so beautiful. And I just was, this whole time I was sad. And so in prayer this morning, I mean, I had things to do, go home, go to soccer game. Then in prayer this morning, I went back to there and I asked myself, I asked God, help me see what's going on here. Why were you sad in this service? So we're creating that space to probe. It might help you to probe with a trusted friend, someone who knows you, who you can talk these things out loud with. I'm noticing in this situation, I'm always feeling this, and I'm trying, and it's keeping me from doing this, and I'm afraid, and I want, help me understand. Next week, I'm going to talk about the Christian practice of spiritual direction, of having a soul friend. And having a soul friend, some of you have them, you didn't know it was called a soul friend, but that person who can create that space for you to probe these areas of your life without fear of judgment. So maybe there's a person in your life with whom you can probe these things. So we notice, then we allow ourselves to go back and we probe. We ask. We ask for the light of insight to shine on this. And then thirdly, we name. We name. This is a way of saying, can I put something concrete to this? Can I begin to say, yes, this is what's going on. I realize now that I'm afraid of my image as the competent one crumbling, right? Because if your image of yourself is the competent one, then my goodness, do you have to work hard to keep that up, don't you? If that's what drives you, being competent. And any time failure or mediocrity begins to show its face in your life, you're going to be afraid that image is going to crumble. Or maybe it's just I'm afraid people won't like me. Maybe that's what's going on here. When you can name something like this, then whatever it is will begin to have less power over us. As soon as we can put a name to our fears, a name to our agendas, we're not going to be free of it, but it can have less power over us. It's one of the reasons I think in the Gospels, Jesus is interested in giving the demon a name before he casts it out. Because being able to name it takes away some of its power. When I was a kid, I'm not seeing many people my age, so this might not ring true for your memory, but when I was a kid, I was watching Saturday morning cartoons, and I watched G.I. Joe, and G.I. Joe always had a little public service announcement during the commercials in between segments, and the public service announcement would go something like this. There would be a little cartoon, and there would be like two little kids spray painting their bicycles in the garage with the garage door shut. I start to get a little dizzy, you know. And then G.I. Joe bursts in, and he says, "Kids, don't you know it's dangerous to spray paint your bikes in an unventilated room?" And they smile and they say, "Thanks, G.I. Joe, now we know." And he says, "Knowing is half the battle." You heard that before? Knowing is half the battle. And that's what we're saying here. Right? We can't become free of our agendas and attachments overnight. But as soon as we recognize them and can name them, knowing that is half the battle. Because then we can recognize it when it shows up in the meeting, in the conversation over the family dinner table. Wherever it is, we can say, "Oh, I recognize you. I see what's going on here." And it won't have quite as much control. Yeah.
Sometimes in this thought process, two things I've noticed. Sometimes I'm probing and thinking, and that goes one way. But if I don't consciously do this, if I relax my mind, somehow that thought process goes differently.
Okay.
The other thing I've noticed is sometime when I'm asleep, or if I'm between sleeping and waking, thoughts and ideas will come that I wouldn't have thought.
Unbidden, right.
And they're very good.
Yes.
So we talk about the Holy Spirit and how we want the Spirit to guide us. Is that a part of...
Yes, thank you. So I don't know if you already said, but there are sometimes our own active mental probing can't get free from what we already know and how we already view ourselves. And so he's suggesting that we can take a more receptive or a more what you might call contemplative approach. When we just relax and allow, we can, I might just take this and bring it to prayer, write about it in my journal, but then just open and try to let my mind be free and ask the Spirit to give me insight. And so we can, there are other ways, kind of more relaxed ways to approach these kinds of things. Yeah. Yeah. So probing does, I'm glad you mentioned that, because probing can have an analytical aspect to it that might not be as helpful. Yeah. So we can probe. We can notice. We can probe. I wonder what another word for this is. A discovery area, but there's an open allowing to this process. We can name, and when we name, that can be very powerful. I think the next thing we can do, if we're courageous enough, is that we can speak. Naming to ourselves is one thing. Speaking out loud what we're discovering to someone else, to others, can be very powerful. So I remember a period in my life when I was getting, in the evenings, I was getting very frustrated with my family and angry and just, I mean, those are the words, frustrated and angry. I became petulant at night. You know, I was worse than my toddler kids. And I had to begin to ask for insight around this. And through prayer and journaling and conversation with my spiritual director, I began to notice that I remembered my dad coming home from work, putting his briefcase down, reading the newspaper, my mom calling us for dinner, coming to have dinner, and then going back to read the newspaper and watch the evening news. And his evening was quiet, and it was peaceful. And I had this image that this is how my evening should go. Right? This is how it should be. And it never did that. I had three young kids in the house. And this is, my dad was 56 when I was born. It's a different generation. We do things differently. Right? But I still had this image. And so I just had to get to the place where I was able to name for my wife and my family and say, you know, I've noticed that I've been angry and frustrated. And I'm realizing that I just have this image of how my evening should go. I'm attached to this idea of having a quiet, and it's just, I don't get to have that right now. And I know that. And I want you to know that I'm becoming aware of that. On the other hand, I also know that I need quiet and silence like I need food. So I've got to figure that out. But I just want you to know that I'm noticing this, right? And so that, naming it aloud for other people, was really helpful in that situation. And I wonder sometimes in a church meeting, for instance, if a chair of a committee or a pastor could say, you know, I've noticed that I've been getting anxious that we're not going to vote for this idea I have. And I just want to let you know that because I really want to lead so that we're open to the Spirit, not so that I get what I want. And I'm trying to lead that way, but it's difficult sometimes. Can you imagine the freedom that that could create in the group? In a group for everyone to begin to notice, because everyone's afraid of something not happening the way they want. So we can speak as well. And then step five would be to act. To act. We begin to act. We begin to live in a way consistent with how we feel God is leading us, even if our feelings haven't caught up yet. So it's right, James Martin, he didn't wait till he was free of his aversion to the hospital to go in. He didn't say, I'm just going to pray about this, and when I start feeling good about the hospital, then I'm going to go in. He had to go in anyway. Right? And so he began to act as if he were free, even though he's a bundle of knots inside. So we can begin to take those steps to act. The Ignatius tradition has a phrase, a little Latin phrase, agere contra, which means to act against, to go against. You notice the attachment, you notice the aversion, so you can begin to act. You can begin to act against that in the direction of freedom, even if you're not completely free. Now, there are other ways in terms of prayer we could talk about these, but we're running out of time. So I just want to just pause and suggest where we are. We've been talking about prayer, but that, in a way, that means life as becoming increasingly open and available to God, to God's transforming Spirit in our lives. That was last week. And so today I just wanted to invite us to begin to notice those places where we're not free, where we can't be open and available. Those places we want to hold back and say, God, you can have all this, but you can't transform this. This is mine, right? Places where we're not free. And then suggest a way of approaching life or prayer. These five steps, you can do them, you can sit down in the evening. It's kind of like an examine. You can use them to review your day, but you also do them in the moment. A way of approaching life that says, how can I be free from these things so that I can be open to your Spirit? Next week, we'll turn to the practice of spiritual friendship, because having soul friends is another practice in the Christian tradition that helps us to be increasingly open and available to the Spirit's leadership in our lives. So I realize it's 10:45 on the dot. I've talked for a solid hour, which I'm sometimes apologetic about. But I appreciated your attention as always, and I look forward to seeing you next week.